This podcast is brought to you by DIA, the trusted global neutral forum for healthcare product development professionals. DIA, driving insights to action.
In 2017, the Clinical Trials Transformation Initiative, known as CTTI or CITI, published an important research paper on patient engagement and clinical trials in DIA's research journal, Therapeutic Innovation and Regulatory Science. The paper is entitled, The Rules of Engagement, CITI Recommendations for Successful Collaborations Between Sponsors and Patient Groups Around Clinical Trials. I am Alberto Grignolo, editor of DIA Global Forum. Today, my guests are Dr. Jeff Sherman, a co-author of this paper. Dr. Sherman is Chief Medical Officer and Executive Vice President at Horizon Pharmaceuticals, and also serves as DIA's liaison to CITI. I'm also pleased to welcome Mr. Ron Bartek, co-founder and president of the Friedreich Ataxia Research Alliance, FARA, to provide his expert perspective on patient engagement in clinical research. Jeff, let me ask you the first question. Let's start with the basics. Why was this research project conducted in the first place?
There's over 7,000 rare diseases, only 5% of treatment, so a large unmet medical need. Part of the CITI mandate is to really look at what can be done to facilitate the conduct of clinical trials to meet these unmet medical needs. And part of this is really looking at how best can stakeholders involved in clinical development work together to make this happen. So it's not only looking at government regulators such as the FDA, individuals in academia who are involved in conducting the studies, industry, which looks to sponsor these studies, but as well as patient groups. And at the end of the day, we're all patients, so have a vested interest in getting new products available to fulfill these unmet medical needs. CITI, working with the Drug Information Association, DIA, first conducted a survey to really look at what were the practices in industry, academia, patient groups regarding engagement in trials, and found there were a lot of differences when they looked at practices across companies, patient groups, et cetera, and really viewed that as a real opportunity to really look at, and this led to this publication entitled The Rules of Engagement, CITI Recommendations for Successful Collaborations Between Sponsors and Patient Groups Around Clinical Trials. And the view was that if we could really outline what were some of the possible best practices, this could, one, facilitate trials, and also for the many, not only industry groups, but patient groups that are involved in clinical trials, actually help to facilitate their work in making this happen so they wouldn't have to fall upon some of the problems that other companies or other patient groups may have had. So with that in mind, what was done was to look at and engaging individuals and going through a questionnaire on what were their practices, what did they view some of the best practices were. So it was really looking at industry representatives, academic representatives, patient group representatives, going through a series of questions, and then really coming up with recommendations on best practices for effective patient group engagement.
I'd like to bring Ron into the conversation and ask you, Ron Bartek, as a representative of the patient community, do you agree with the premise of the study, and what is your perspective on how the study was conducted before we get to the recommendations and results of the study?
I agree with every single word and the spirit of Jeff's comments entirely, and that was the way I saw it. From my perspective as a patient advocate that was brought into the working group that produced these recommendations. And I think Jeff's described both the methodology and the objectives very well.
Do you feel, Ron, that the patient voice was represented fairly in the methodology of the study?
Absolutely. And there were a handful of patient advocates involved in the very working group, and a good number of patient advocacy organizations and patient groups were involved in the interviews, of course. We were patient organizations, and patients were one of the major stakeholders subject to the surveys and made comments from beginning to end. So we felt very well served, and that we had been able to make genuine contributions to what has been widely considered throughout the stakeholder community as a very sound and valuable set of recommendations to all the stakeholders.
Okay, well, let's come to those recommendations then. Jeff, could I ask you to list maybe the most significant recommendations arising from this research?
They were three categories, Alberto, in terms of the recommendation. There was one category for all stakeholders, so again, individuals in either academia, sponsors, patient groups. Then there was for research sponsors, which could either be academic sites or industry. And then the third was patient groups. First and foremost, you'll hear this as a theme, which is involving everyone as early as possible. Because a lot of times what was found previously is that patients would get involved, other groups would get involved if a clinical study was in trouble. And that's usually then cleanup work versus trying to build quality in from day one. And it's really more than just getting involved at the early stage in terms of a single study. What could really help the whole process is getting involved early on in terms of the whole development program. And what Ron will go through and describe in more detail as an example is what the Friedreich's Ataxia Research Alliance, or FARA, has done in really not only building an infrastructure, but making it very easy for sponsors to work with them to facilitate the whole process from regulatory engagement, clinical plan, individual study design, et cetera.
So one clear recommendation, as I understand from you, is to involve patients and all stakeholders as early as possible in the development of a new medicine.
Absolutely. And it comes back to a point I made earlier, is that with over 7,000 rare diseases, only 5% of which have treatments, it means there's a large unmet medical need. And for a lot of these diseases, and Ronald can elaborate specifically on Friedreich's ataxia, there's no approved treatment. So for companies that get involved in an area, they may or may not have expertise in the company. And so it's really looking to turn to then either patient groups, academic medical centers that may have expertise to really help, again, to give insights on the disease state, what may be discussions that they have had with regulators to help facilitate the program and really not delay the availability of these agents. Because again, we're all patients, and any delay in getting a product through to the market could certainly delay treatment for a patient that may have any one of these conditions.
Ron, if you would please, in relation to engaging early with patients, how do you feel about that? And is there any time that is too early for engagement? Is that even possible?
That's a great question, and I would say the answer is resoundingly no. It's never too early. And just to reinforce the excellent points that Jeff's just made, I'd say that, you know, if you look at the city mission, it was to improve, enhance the entire clinical trial enterprise. And what we learned early on was that you begin to improve the clinical trial design, the clinical trial enterprise completely, when you get started with the patient community early. And by early, we mean even pre-discovery. You don't wait until you've got a clinical trial candidate and you want to get patients to be recruited and enroll in your study. You start with a basic scientist, with a pre-discovery scientist, looking for the right targets in that disease group. If you select the wrong targets, doesn't matter how good your trial design is, you're not going to get there. So you start working with patients, even with the basic scientist, selecting the right targets, and by working with the patients, you figure out what targets make the most difference for them, which targets in their biology dictates the quality of life or lack thereof, and therefore are most important to them and will draw them most effectively into these clinical trials. So that's the importance of starting early and getting the patient's voice involved in dictating the target selection, dictating the things that the patient groups are doing on a daily basis now, are building the assets that Jeff's referring to that attract our other stakeholder partners to our disease group. And these are things like collecting the patient's voice and taking it to these other stakeholders, along with the very well-developed assets such as, you've probably heard a lot, Alberto, about importance of natural history data.
Yes.
And you've got any number of patient groups like ours, FARA, developing very robust natural history databases from which our sponsor company partners can mine for such things as which patient symptoms are most targetable, most important to the patient, which procedures in a clinical trial will be well tolerated, which portions of the patient population are best suited to that particular therapy, which clinical outcome measures will be best suited to measuring the impact of that therapy on those patients. Natural history studies that all of us are conducting or trying to conduct, and in the younger, shorter in the tooth organizations, are absolutely essential for success in the clinical trial enterprise. Also, we're assembling assets such as preclinical tools. I'm talking about things like assays, cell and animal models, biosamples that our stakeholder sponsors are using in their preclinical studies to test their drugs and other therapies. Development of patient registries that are so vitally important in terms of recruitment of patient participants in the clinical trials, and the support of clinical networks that contain clinicians and nurse coordinators that not only know our disease, but know our patients because they see them on a regular basis. And these are the sites that we're supporting, that our sponsors are coming to conduct their clinical trials. So it's really an entire network of assets that our patient organizations are developing now that our company sponsors and partners and colleagues recognize will save them a lot of time and money and greatly improve the prospects of success of their clinical research. And by success, we mean all stakeholders agree the success is written in the number of treatments you get to patients. And Jeff's already rehearsed the large unmet medical need in our community.
Yeah, Ron, let me follow up with the more specific question, and that is, over time, patients and patient groups have complained that some drug developers have used endpoints that are easy to measure but are not necessarily important to patients. And yeah, my understanding is that patients want endpoints that matter, not necessarily endpoints that can secure regulatory approval. Do you see this study and studies like it and the current movement towards greater patient engagement as possible solutions to this complaint from the patient community?
Excellent question. I would say that in our particular community and a good number of other communities with which I'm quite familiar, because all these patient groups are trying to work together, we have so many similarities that this is one similarity that's widespread. We're all interested in better biomarkers. We're all interested in better clinical outcome endpoints that will measure things of importance to our patients. I will say that we've made a lot of progress, and we're in constant communication with our dear colleagues at Food and Drug Administration, for example, because they're equally intense about the need for such outcome measures. And there's been a lot of progress made in coming up with approaches that not only meet the regulatory requirements, but through our constant addressing of the patient voice and getting these patient-focused drug development meetings conducted that maybe you've heard a bit about, we're pulling together clinical outcome measures that are meaningful to the patients and that are of keen interest at the FDA. I'll say that there's been such progress in that regard that now we're looking to refine the technologies for measuring those endpoints and trying to shift them from always being focused on the measures being taken in the clinical sites every 3 months when they come in for that one exam, to also measuring things that are harder to report on, things like fatigue and energy levels, and things that, you know, Jeff and I talked about endlessly, about when you hear from a patient or a patient family that they feel that they're deriving benefit from the therapy that's being administered in a clinical trial, but the endpoints aren't detecting that benefit. Well, that drives us both to the FDA and to our technology gurus to say, okay, well, how are we going to measure that more sensitively so that we can pick up, detect these benefits?
Okay,
but we're all
Thank
in this together. We've got our sponsors and the FDA and our patients all on the same page. We're all thriving to cross that finish line together.
Is there another recommendation among the most important ones that you would like to mention?
it's building the trust required for a successful collaboration. And that really means looking at this as not just, oh, we need you to help us get enrollment done in this study, but really looking at it much broader in terms of, it's not just getting the study done, it's making the drug available. It's, while the drug's in the market, helping to address any post-marketing requirements, safety surveillance. So it's building that trust for successful collaboration and really looking at what are the keys to that, such as transparency, following up on commitments, honoring confidentiality. And that's going to get into some of the challenges in really making this work, because sometimes it's easier said than done. My other hat, other than the DIA liaison, as you mentioned early on, I'm chief medical officer at Horizon Pharma. The reason we collaborated with FARA is FARA made it, not to be too trite, turnkey to really work with them, so that rather than Horizon having to build an infrastructure for not only a study, but to move a product forward in Friedreich's ataxia, FARA had set up a number of the items that we would otherwise had to have done and made it much easier to work and essentially removed any excuses not to work. So you can usually come up with all the reasons, you know, why not to do something, and removed all of those barriers, as Ron stated. They had already been engaged with the FDA on study endpoints. They had already had a very good understanding of the natural history of the disease. They already had a patient registry set up to really facilitate enrollment. They have a collaborative clinical research network of study sites to do the study. They had worked with a third-party academic CRO to facilitate conduct of studies. They certainly clearly understood the importance of confidentiality as well as managing expectations, especially, unfortunately, in a field of Friedreich's ataxia where, unfortunately, there's been more misses than hits. The single biggest thing from the recommendation, in addition to working early and often, is really making sure as well to set up those softer aspects of a collaboration for long-term success in terms of transparency, following up on commitments, timeliness, honoring confidentiality, etc.
Ron, may I ask you to comment on this recommendation, specifically the aspect of trust? The recommendation seems to suggest between the lines that trust has been low or is low. So from a patient perspective, what does it take to build a strong relationship based on trust?
Well, I first want to commend the question, because as Jeff indicated, there's nothing more important in our community than trust. And for us, that means two things. It means the trust that we have worked for a long, long time to develop between our patients and their families and our organization. And that is just unbelievably important, absolutely essential in the work that we've been able to accomplish in our community. So it's that trust. It's really two vectors of trust. It's the trust between our organization and our patient community, and then it's the trust that Jeff referred to between our organization and our sponsors like Horizon Pharma on the other. Once those two trust vectors are well established, those partnerships become real. They become genuine. They become essential rather than token. And as soon as they become essential based on that solid foundation of trust, you start making giant strides from the very beginning of your process all the way through to the end. And you never have to look up. You never have to question each other. You know you're on a rock solid foundation. It's just a matter, let's get the right answer together and let's get it as quickly as possible and then move on to the next question. It's really the trust that's invaluable as a way of making the partnership real, genuine, and essential.
Let me force a little metric on you, if I may. On a scale of 1 to 10, where is the trust today?
Well, if you're talking about the trust between Horizon and FARA, it's at a 10, assuming that 10 is the highest evaluation.
That would be the assumption. But I was intending the question to be more general, overall, in the community, including patients. So what is the level of trust today? And what can we expect it to be in 2 years and 5 years?
Maybe I'll take the first crack at that. I'm eager to hear Jeff. Jeff and I have never talked about it from that vantage point. I'd split it into two parts. I'd say in the rare disease communities, that trust is quite high. I would say it's probably up there around an 8. In the common disease community, I'd say it's quite low. And we can talk more about that later. But I don't see the same level of trust and confidence and essential nature of partnerships in the common disease space as I do in the rare disease space. So I'd say in the common disease space, it might be down below 5. That's just a very rough off-the-cuff assessment. What do you think?
Thank you for taking the risk. Jeff, what is your perspective? You've worked in large diseases and orphan diseases, of course. What do you think?
I would agree with Ron. It's somewhat variable. I think in established disease states where there may be a track record for getting drugs approved, where there's large patient populations, let's say osteoarthritis per se, where there's, I believe, around 26 million patients with osteoarthritis, there may be less of a need to engage, let's say, a patient group, or there may be a number of patient groups than, let's say, in a rare disease state where almost by necessity, sponsors and patient groups have to come together to really try and make it happen just for the very nature of something being rare. Now, having said that, there are differences, and Ron could speak to this from another hat that he wears as being on the board of the National Organization of Rare Diseases. Some real differences between patient groups in terms of how long they've been established and what resources they may have or put into place. And, you know, and Ron, you can really go through this from the perspective of when FARA was first started with what resources and knowledge FARA had in a short period of time, relatively short period of time, where FARA is today. And that's part of the challenge. And really, that again reinforces, Alberto, why this article on rules of engagement to really say not only to sponsors, academic centers, patient groups, you're not alone. Others have been through this, and what we're doing, and this is not a one-off publication, DIA continues to do work in this area. How do we continue to move this forward? How do we make sure that, let's say, a nascent patient group in a newly discovered rare disease can really learn from other patient groups on how to really move forward to address that unmet need, how best to engage with academic groups, et cetera. So again, somewhat variable, maybe some less necessity in some of the larger diseases versus smaller diseases, but still the same principles apply. Anything that could be done to really work together just benefits all of us as potential patients with these diseases.
I wanted to get back to the recommendations. Jeff, were there any surprising recommendations that caused either you or Ron to scratch your heads and say, that's interesting, that's surprising?
It would seem intuitive in a way, Alberto, that everyone really should work together and that early on, it's like any type of relationship, you really want to establish some basics and go into this, looking at it as a long-term relationship. And that if individuals weren't approaching it that way, it could be, is there something about the group, company, whatever they've been exposed or not, or prior experience that may have had an impact on why they may view things. I mean, for us, and the reason we were able to quickly come together and collaborate is it was pretty intuitive for both Aaron and Horizon that this was the way to go. And I think it also is the fact that, Alberto, as you know from your involvement with DIA, in order to really be successful in drug development, it is bringing those four pillars together of government regulators, patient groups, industry, study sites, academic centers to make this work and to look for ways to really pull this together. For others, it may or may not be as intuitive.
I don't think Jeff found any particular recommendation surprising. What we found surprising was that because it was so intuitively obvious to us that this is the way we should be operating together, that we were surprised to see that it wasn't universally accepted as such and not absolutely fully embraced from the get-go. And again, it broke down, I think back to the experts meeting that's referred to in the article that Jeff helped author, that took place in January of 2015, at which we heard sponsor panels that included rare and common disease companies. We heard a couple of the common disease companies say, we don't get this. Why are we here? Why are we talking about engaging patients early and often? We really don't need them until we're recruiting a phase 3 clinical trial. We've been conducting clinical trials in our space, in our common disease, for 50 years. We know how to do it. We don't need patient advice on how to select targets and which endpoints to use. Well, I think by the end of that meeting even, and certainly as time went on, we kept working with these people, I think they did move closer to the realization that even in the common disease spaces, there are things that should be learned from patients. Take, for example, some of the diseases that are having real trouble, despite the fact they have millions of patients, they have trouble convincing those patients to come participate in their clinical trials. And there again, you have the issue of trust. Those clinics have not established the kind of trust between themselves and the patient groups, and their clinicians, their go-to doctors, agree that those are the trials they should participate in. We were both surprised the fact that we had work to do to convince some more and more people that this was the way to go.
And speaking of work to do, recommendations are fine, but implementation is where the devil resides, if you will. So let me ask you, is there any low-hanging fruit? Are there any recommendations that either of you believes can be implemented relatively quickly or easily?
Alberto, it's really taking and looking at this publication. There are some others as well. And looking at, okay, depending on the situation and where, let's say, if it's from a sponsor perspective, is this early stage, is it later stage? You can't go back and correct some things that may have already occurred. But it's really looking at, before we move on, have we really looked at what is, if it's the sponsor, the patient perspective? If it's the patient, is it, what can we do to make this more enticing for a sponsor to want to get involved? So it's almost looking at the low-hanging fruit here is that if I'm in somebody else's shoes, what would I be looking for? And sometimes that helps with a breakthrough in how people are thinking or approaching something. Because at the end of the day, everyone wants the same thing, which is how do we get a product available to patients sooner than later?
Ron, what do you think is some low-hanging fruit for implementation of the recommendations?
Well, right along what Jeff just said, I would say that one of our recommendations to sponsors was that not all patient groups are created equal, basically, and to assess which assets the various patient groups in your space have made available to you, figure out the low-hanging fruit would be described as and defined by the best prepared patient communities. And by best prepared, we mean which ones of them have robust natural history data, which ones have clinical networks, which ones have patient registries that are invaluable in recruiting and enrolling clinical trials, which one of them have provided preclinical tools for assessing in your preclinical toxicology studies, for example, or even efficacy studies in animals and cells, and which have established sound, fruitful relationships with the National Institutes of Health and the Food and Drug Administration, and even regulators in other countries. So there's so much of that foundational work that is being done by some patient groups and can really help the company define low-hanging fruit. I would suggest that low-hanging fruit is the best prepared patient communities and patient organizations.
At the other end of the spectrum of recommendation implementations, what is the biggest challenge in implementing one or more of these recommendations?
If it's from a sponsor perspective, typically what gets looked at is, so what is the return on, typically it's investment, if we invest in doing this one development program versus another. We're looking at this in a different way, and this is part of the next step in the engagement process, is the return on engagement. So what this means is that return on engagement and really being able to quantify it can really help if it's management, a patient group, to really understand, here's the real tangible benefit. we can shave X number of weeks, months, years off a development program. We may be able to save X amount or Y amount of money that can be used for other programs. So there's really something really quantifiable that people can see, touch, and feel to say, okay, I understand. Because some of the times the biggest hurdle is the, for lack of a better term, the sell piece for somebody to be actually convinced to say, here's what I get out of this, not just qualitative, quantitatively as well.
Okay, so is early engagement going to be a big hurdle, or will building trust be a big hurdle, or are there any other obstacles in a way that would require years to overcome?
Certainly the trust really comes with, there needs to be some period of time. Depending on the individuals, that trust can be built maybe earlier versus later. But part of this is really trying to build in what we would say is some early wins. So if you have, let's say, a key milestone that's 3 years out, is there a way of having an earlier milestone to have some wins which can really reinforce, hey, this is great, along the way to really reinforce why we're really doing this and why we're really engaged versus deferred gratification.
Ron, from your perspective, what is the biggest challenge?
I would say, to state it from the FARA Horizon perspective first, that there are no hurdles, that we get it. Our two organizations get it in full, because we've already enjoyed the fruits of this kind of genuine, fully engaged partnership, and we recognize its great value. A big hurdle is that there are a lot of sponsors out there, a lot of companies who have not yet fully engaged patient groups, so they don't get it yet. And for that hurdle, what Jeff said is absolutely essential, and that is developing the kind of metrics to measure the value that they have not yet experienced, and then demonstrating against those metrics that this approach not only saves time and money in real terms, but it greatly improves your chances of success, your prospects for success of getting approvals. And so I'd say convincing the stakeholders who have not yet fully engaged that this is of great value, and developing the metrics to demonstrate that great value.
One key point before we close, for those listeners who want to learn more, Citi will be celebrating their 10-year anniversary this coming February 6th. And as part of that, they're holding a symposium. So for those of you out in the audience who want to learn more about patient groups and clinical trials, there will be a whole session on implementation and impact, patient groups and clinical trials, in which Ron and I will be speaking, as well as Ken Getz, who's another fellow of the DIA, on this whole topic area for those of you who may want to learn more.
Very good. Thank you, Jeff. In fact, I am signed up for that, and I will see you both there. But that's the end of our time together today. I want to thank you both for your insights and great conversation. Jeff Sherman, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Ron Bartek, thank you for joining us and providing me the patient perspective. Much appreciated.
Thank you very much for having us.
For DIA Global Forum, I am Alberto Grignolo.
To learn more about this topic, visit us online at diaglobal.org.